Welcome to BrainMachineNetwork.com.
How to produce live comedy with your friend Emily. How to produce live comedy with E-M-I-L-Y Emily.
Hi, I'm Emily Winter, a writer, comedian, producer, and potato person in Brooklyn. I've been producing a Time Out New York critics pick show called Back Fat Variety since 2012, and also produced two other Time Out critics picks, Comedy at Rose Gold and Side Ponytail. In 2017, I co-created a national anti-Trump comedy festival that raised over $50,000 for the ACLU, and I've written for TV Land, Fusion, Glamour, the Barnes & Noble Review, and I'm an NBC Late Night Writers Workshop script judge and alum. Enjoy the podcast. And I'm so sorry about this cold that I've got. Jesus. Oh, I don't have it in the actual podcast recording. Hi, welcome to How to Produce Live Comedy. I'm Emily Winter, and today my guest is producer Marianne Ways. Thank you for joining me, Marianne. I'm so excited to have you on.
Thanks for having me. You have a great radio voice.
Oh, thank you. I interned at public radio when I was in college, and I have such a high voice. Mm-hmm. And they were like, we can't put you on the air like this, and so they actually like gave me radio training, so I think sometimes
that's
I get
amazing.
Into it. Yeah
I feel like the only it's either like my regular voice, which when I listen back to it I'm like, am I a valley girl? I don't understand what happened. Or it's like super like a phone sex operator. Hey, welcome to podcast time.
That's how I kind of feel too. No, it's very fun though. But you're like, their whole trick is like you have to hit hot button words no matter where they are in a sentence. So like, and even if they don't apply, so it'd be like, there were no murders or abortions in Wisconsin today, you know? Anyway. All right. Well, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast because you produce wonderful shows. And the New York Times just did a profile on you, which was very cool. Were you so excited for that?
It was crazy. I've never had so many family members be like, oh, that's what you do.
Yeah.
I mean, that was wild. Yeah.
What... I have so many questions, but you were just talking about before we started the podcast that you used to work at The Onion. What did you do at The Onion?
I just did events and promotions.
Cool.
So a lot of their advertising partners, if they wanted to do a live event in New York or LA, I would help kind of coordinate that and make it happen and many other things. It was when it was in New York in, I don't even know, 2006 or 7 or 8. I haven't bought it.
Before they moved to Chicago.
Before they moved to Chicago. And this was actually when I guess they thought they were staying in New York for a long time. So they opened an uptown office, literally, it was not quite uptown. It was the regular office was in Soho, and this was just above Union Square. So this was like the business and promotions office. So.
The serious office.
Kind of the serious office, other than the fact that my boss kept a pair of roller skates under his desk that he swore he was going to use, and I was the only person that used them in the office.
Wait, they were supposed to be office skates?
No.
I think he just
them delivered to the office. He's like, I'm going to roller skate my dog around town, and he never did. And
oh, my
so
God.
Once every couple of weeks when I was just like, I need to de-stress, I would just put on those skates. And
when you left, did you take the skates?
No. And that's the thing. I'm still mad about it because I'm going to reach out to him because I don't think he ever used those skates. We were the same size, and those were some good skates.
Does he still work at The Onion?
Absolutely not.
Did you?
No. I don't think anyone who was in that office still works at The Onion.
Did you leave when they moved?
No, I left before that. When I was there for maybe a little over a year, and I ran into a couple of women that I knew at a comedian's going away party, and I was like, I'm gonna work with you guys, because they worked at a comedy club.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the women was like, actually, I'm leaving, you should talk to my boss. And so I left to go book a comedy club.
Was that your first booking job?
The first full-time legitimate booking job.
What club was it?
Comics with an X.
Right, I remember that.
Yeah.
On 14th Street?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So you worked there. They closed down. That was such a good club.
It was. I mean, you know, they had a good heyday, which was, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. And I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much I'm supposed to talk about it, but their basement flooded right around the time
I came in.
And so they did these like million-dollar renovations, and you know, the club was doing pretty well after that. And then that's when the economy tanked right after that.
Yes, yeah.
And things just changed. And eventually, I think they wound up selling by this time I was gone. And the people that bought it, I don't think had any idea how to run a comedy club. And yeah, but I mean, so many great comedians came through there. And I feel like that was the place that really like bridged the club comics and with the alternative comics. Because back then it was still like a line that split down the middle. And Rocky Dubin, she was the original. And then again later, the headliner, the booker of the weekend headliners. And she's the one that brought me in. And I think she was the one that was really responsible for that. Like, you know, bringing Kurt and Kristen into a comedy club. And, you know, I mean, she headlined like John Oliver at the time.
I saw John Oliver when I was like 23.
Oh my God. That was probably around the same time. Yeah, that you were. That was probably the same. It probably was that.
It's so funny that you talk about I'm 33. So like when the economy tanked, I think I was like 23 or 20. And I didn't have money, but I was a kid. So like everyone was like, oh no, we have no money. And I was like, yeah, hello.
Nobody has money.
I was like, yep. I'm not upset. I was going to make 20 grand a year either way. Yeah. But it's so weird. I mean, and how it affected comedy and everything. So when you left comics, where did you, I guess I just, maybe we should even back it up. How did you get like into producing comedy?
The very short story is I had met David Wayne from Wet Hot American Summer and MTV's Estate. And through him, like I started helping him with events. And there's a much longer story there, but that's the shortest version. And through him, I met Eugene Merman, who had been opening up for him at a Stella show and, you know, working the merch table for Stella. And he came over and, you know, we're like, what other shows do you do? And he's like, oh, I run a weekly show in the East Village. You guys should come. And my friends and I wound up going to that show, invite them up every Wednesday for, I don't know, until it ended. And through there, I just kept meeting different comedians and through David. And, you know, my background was in originally music, marketing, publicity, promotions.
Is that what you went to school for?
I went to school for, I think, I should know this, like marketing and advertising. Yeah, something along those lines. And I mean, in college, so I thought I would work in music. And I had this great PR professor who was like, oh, well, you should, you know, talk to this guy, Bernie Punt, who does marketing over at the Bryce Jordan Center, which was the big arena at Penn State. And so I applied for an internship and didn't hear back. And my professor was like, did you follow up? I was like, oh, okay, you have to follow up with people.
What?
It was little, you know, these little things you just have no idea about. And I followed up and got this internship. And Bernie was great. It was, he let all of the interns be really hands-on. And so we were creating these like huge marketing, like promo pushes, and it was a chance to be like really creative. And you know, it's kind of that time when I realized, oh, you just have to be really organized, really creative, and then you can make anything happen.
Oh, it makes me so happy to hear you say it. I'm like a big organizational freak.
Oh my God, you can't not be.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I but I think so many people are like, oh, like being organized and sort of type A about things is at odds with creativity, but I don't.
Right,
yeah.
Absolutely. I have people a lot of the time say like, why are you worrying about this so much? You need to chill out. I'm like, oh no, I'm worrying now because I'm anticipating all of the problems that could happen in the future, so that those problems never happen and no one else has to worry about it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so key.
And so you're not scrambling at the last minute. And And that's the difference. That's like what makes a good show, you know?
Absolutely. And so I wound up working at the arena for a year as the marketing assistant and wanted to move to New York. Got a job in New York at Big Apple Circus, literally a circus, doing doing direct marketing. And that's around the time I met David. And so my daytimes were for 4 years working at the circus, and then at 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about this circus?
We can talk about the circus. I love Big Apple Circus.
Elephants, yes or no?
No.
Oh, good.
No,
okay.
I mean, that's the funny thing.
Like, I'm obsessed with elephants.
Yeah, they're good.
I love them so much. I'm like, oh no.
Who doesn't love an elephant?
I love this circus. Tell me more about
this
circus.
No, it's funny. I mean, so they're a not-for-profit circus.
Okay.
And so, and they... Yeah. So, I mean, I was always never liked clowns growing up. I was a vegetarian for 16 years, you know, and I would always like be like, oh, the circus, fun. And then I would just be like, oh, this is sad.
Yeah.
Like Ringling or whatever it was. And Big Apple was a one ring circus. And it was more, I would compare it to like Cirque du Soleil for kids. So like a lot of acrobatics, very few clowns. Like they would have an MC. they would have some very like minimal clowning, but like the clowns were all lovely. And the animals that they had were mainly like just dogs, cats, birds, and horses.
Wonderful.
And so they were treated wonderfully. And then they did all these wonderful programs. Like they do the, what is it? The like clowns in the hospitals, like clown care program is what it's called. And I went on clown rounds once and oh my God, I was like crying by the end because it was kids who don't want to get a shot and they've been in a hospital for 4 months and then the clown walks in and all of a sudden they're like the happiest they've ever been. And they do like, you know, visually impaired and like hearing impaired performances and it's, they're great. They're wonderful. And I feel very lucky that I worked there. And
that's very cool.
Yeah. And I'm still in, I mean, honestly, I'm still in touch with so many. I mean, I'm going so many places in this story, but yeah, I mean, when I went to work at the Onion, one of the first events we did was an event at Museum of Sex. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, what can we do that's fun? I was like, well, I know a woman who's a clown on the side, but then separately her main gig, her name is Mistress B, and she is like, she dresses like this, almost like a, she, like, she looks like a drag queen. And she has this like Madonna bodice that she uses to blow up air balloons, and she makes dirty balloon animals.
Oh, she's amazing. I know. Oh, my John, our producer's face is like,
she's amazing. Look her up. And then like years later, she and I and another woman called Lady I, who she is like a sideshow performer and does sword swallowing, like the three of us started a show called Unmasked that was amazing. And I feel like we should bring it back. It was so long ago, where we would invite people who like, this is their onstage persona. Mm-hmm. And then that was the first half of their set. The second half of their set was they would strip down to normal clothing kind of on set and then show their other skill, which was like whether it was writing or performing stand up. It was incredible.
That's
I'm jumping around so much. No, I don't even know where I am in the story right now.
To the air.
How I helped comedians. Yeah, okay.
This is a less like this. I'm just like curious about your journey. Sure. So like
it's all part of it. Great.
Where does the air come out of to fill up the does it come out of the boobs?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
The air
nipple.
Comes out
the
of
air the nipple.
Oh
yeah.
My God, I want this bodice.
She's amazing.
I didn't know that. I thought I had found my calling, but I think maybe I haven't. Maybe this is I want to make dirty balloon animals.
Yeah, take a balloon. Bending class, is that what they call it? Balloon bending.
God,
I don't know.
That's so
amazing.
Funny.
So yeah, so I was at the circus. Yeah, so all of this ties in where by the time I met these comedians and I was, you know, running events for David, these Wet Hot American Summer screenings, people would like these actors would come up and be like, "You seem organized. Can you help me get organized? Or you like, how did you get all these people here?
Yeah,
can you help me promote my show or myself?" Mm-hmm. Or and I was like, "Yeah, absolutely." And it was just something that I was doing for fun. And, you know, these were my friends, I
guess. Were you charging them?
No, never. Yeah. Of course not. I didn't start making money from comedy until probably started, I guess when I started working at The Onion, if you want to count that.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, it was just for fun in the evenings. And my friends and I, you know, back then, comedy wasn't the go-to. Mm-hmm. I think it was still music for the most part. Uh-huh. And there were very few alternative comedy rooms. There were comedy clubs. And, of course, people went there on the weekends to go to a comedy club, but it wasn't typically people of our, like at our age. And
yeah,
like maybe you went to the Cellar every now and again, and that was really exciting, but it wasn't just something you thought, oh, I could do this every night.
Right.
And like,
you're describing my early 20s. I didn't start comedy until I was 27, but you're describing my early 20s in New York. I was just like going to comics and the Cellar.
Right. Absolutely.
And then,
And so, I mean, at this time, the venues where we hung out were UCB, of course. And then Rafifi, where Invite Them Up was, Mo Pickens until it closed, Luna Lounge. Like there were a few, and they were all kind of centered around in the East Village, which was amazing.
Yeah.
So that's how it all started. I mean, you know, there wasn't really such a thing as a comedy fan back then, and we didn't consider ourselves that because these were just people we had made friends with that were really funny, and we're like, oh, we'll come support you,
we'll
hang out, and you know, we'll have a great time. And so it just kind of was all very organic. And I mean, the comedians didn't have to be that nice to us, but I guess we were just nice people hanging out in a bar.
Yeah.
You know?
But also, like, you were helping
out. And then we were helping out.
Yeah.
Exactly. Anytime we could. And, you know, at some point, like, Eugene, the show used to be free, and he was like, we're going to start charging $5 at the door. Do you guys want to do that? And we're like, yeah, sure. We're here anyway.
Yeah.
And
would he give you a cut of that?
Yeah. I think I would take $20 to take a cab home.
Oh, great.
That's it.
And that's what you need, know?
That's all you need.
Were there things that you did back then when you started that are still like really effective promotional tools now, or producing lessons that are like, because we were just right before the podcast started, we were talking about, oh, it's so hard to give lessons because everything changes so like fast now.
Yeah, it's completely different. I mean, back then, the only things that remain the same are writing press releases and submitting them to media. Exactly. Of course, it's
my boyfriend changed. And I have argued about this. Actually, I told him, okay, do you, this is such a stupid question, but do you attach your release in the email or do you put it in the body of the email?
Well, I don't do it anymore, but it depends. I used to attach it, and I think by the, like, you know, I think the last time I did press releases was like 6 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And I started truncating them a lot. I didn't I would stop sending out full press releases and just kind of do more event listings, unless it was for a larger event, in which case, I mean, I moved over to MailChimp at some point, and so it was in the body of the MailChimp email.
Okay.
But yeah, no, yeah, I do not send attachments because I feel like it's one too many steps now.
That, yeah, I agree. I told my boyfriend when I was like teaching him to produce his shows, oh, put him in the attachment. And now I'm like, no.
That's how
people won't click. Exactly. They'll never click.
Yes, yeah. It's changed a lot. I remember once when I was an agent, I had sent an email to a couple of the agents that I work with, and I ended the copy of, like, you know, like, hey, here's the show description and here's all the information, and I ended it with ####, because that's how you used to end a press release. Yeah. Was it signifies the end. And my coworker yells through the window, she's like, did you just hashtag your email? And I was like, no. It means something different.
So
but we're
funny.
10 years apart, and it's,
yeah,
you know,
they don't know. Oh my god, that's so funny. I just sent something with it at the bottom.
I feel like you should still do that, because then people that work in media still probably know
that's
it. Just means you've reached the end of the promotional, like, materials.
Right.
That's so funny. But yeah, so I still, you know, again, I don't do this anymore, but well, that's not true. Like, when I start a new show, I will send out a press release. But at this point, I feel like everything has become so casual, because in order to be successful in public relations, your job is to know the media outlets,
people.
The people at the media outlets. And so, which is hard. That's why I kind of didn't try to get into music in New York. So I was like, well, my whole press list is invalid now because I'm not in Pennsylvania anymore. Do I really want to spend time figuring out who all the people are that I need to reach out to? But I slowly started figuring out in New York, and if I wanted to know, I would find out. I would call a paper back then, and where I would, you know, now it's a lot easier because you can just look online, and it's a lot of them don't even accept press releases. It's just event listings. And yeah, for years, I'm sure I still have one, but it's a really outdated press list where, you know, even when I was at Booking Union Hall full time, like, I took their press list and updated it. And, you know, it's just, what's the publication? What, you know, when are they listing? What are they listing? Who's the contact? And then I would always have interns, you know, teach them how to write a press release or an event listing or whatever, which was usually just event listings. And the difference to me, a press release is going to be more full information in the hopes that someone will write a story about it. I think that's what I would kind of.
So you're sort of pitching it in that way.
Right. Like, because a lot of journalists, not a lot, but some journalists these days, they just don't have time, and they're like, just give me the information. So in that case, you're giving them background information on anyone involved. You're giving them a synopsis of what the show is. You're giving them quotes, you know, that's something that I don't do too often. And my friend was like, you should really be doing that. I was like, right. You know, like, if I'm starting a new show with Sashir Zameda, I'm going to ask her, like, hey, can you give me tell me what the show is in your own words?
Yeah.
So they can just pull a quote.
That's
and then
very
the hope,
smart.
The hope is that they, you know, the journalist will read that and either reprint it or reach out to you and say, hey, this is great. Can you actually put me directly in touch with the talent?
Right.
Or can I ask you a few more questions? Because, you know, most of the legwork's already done, but then, you know, a good journalist will say, well, I actually want to, you know, dig into this a little bit more and tell people, but I see why this is an interesting show and our readers would be interested in it.
Right.
For me, an event listing is just who's where, when,
show.
Why.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, you know.
It's the simple information to plug in.
Very smart and something that I haven't talked about on this podcast yet. And like, a lot of people from other cities have been listening. And so I feel like if you're starting a show in another city, like, and you're the only person doing this type of show, that could be story worthy. So maybe you do want to do the whole press release with quotes.
Absolutely.
And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, cause you know, here things get buried and lost and there are 1,000 comedy shows, but absolutely in other cities, you know, that's something really special. And, you know, you're bringing added value to the entertainment community of your town. And, you know, so maybe that's when you're starting a new show. Or if you have a monthly show that varies a little bit, that's a great time to send a press release. Whereas, you know, or if you start a new show, send the press release and then follow up if it's a weekly show with a lineup or a monthly show, just saying like, you know, always include the show description again. Oh, like, you know, and then you're including, why is this show different this month? Or, you know, what's special about it? Even if it's just, we have one special guest or whatever it is. Yeah. You know?
I work on a weekly with like four other comedians, and we, I've noticed that like sending, when I email press, sending the next like four or five lineups with like the headliners, is a great way of not bothering. Cause that's the other thing is like, you don't want to bug somebody too much. It's just, then I feel like you're just shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah, that's true. And every publication's different. But at the same time, if you have a weekly show and you're not booking it until whatever, a week before.
Right.
It's, you know, it is their job to accept
information. True.
But you're right. You can absolutely. I have one friend who runs a website that drives him crazy when people do this or do that. And I'm like, okay, I love you, but they don't know what they're doing. And he, you know, he got mad at me because, you know, he's like, you never send me anything. I was like, well, yeah, but you do the work for me, which is terrible. It's terrible. Like, I should not be doing that. And I like thank him every time I think of it. But he's like, no one ever says thank you after I've listed them. I'm like, well, yeah, but that's a lot of work to even just create the list, like create, put the information in one place, send it to you and send it to 12 other people.
Because he has a form. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. But like, you know, it is, that's a lot of extra work to go and follow up and see who has listed me. But yeah, sure. Absolutely. If it's someone that you know personally that's running a site and they keep listing you, send a thank you.
Yeah. That's,
I mean, these
very
are
smart.
Your relationships.
Right.
You know,
right. Right.
You, again, you don't want to flood their inbox and thank them every time, but like, you know.
No,
yeah.
You're right. I send them a thank you every like new year, but I should do it more often.
That's hilarious. But that's nice.
So anyway, back to comics.
Sure.
So you were working there and then you left.
Then I got laid off during the economy crash.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And then what?
Then I almost moved to Seattle. Then, oh my God.
Oh my
God.
Then
my life fell apart. But that's another story. And I almost left New York. And I was like, maybe I'll go to Seattle. And I went there for a month and loved it. But was like, I can't do this. Like,
yeah.
it rained for a week and I didn't leave the house. I caught up on Mad Men. That was great. But and so I came back to New York and I was like, I need a break from comedy, because that was kind of my first step into the industry of it all.
Mm-hmm.
With not, you know, not at the fault of comics so much, but just, you know. It's my first time after working in comedy for 6 or 7 years dealing with agents and managers. And it just so happened that my interactions were not the greatest when I was at that club. And so I was like, I'm out. And
okay.
So I actually went and worked in kids' book publishing because I have a background in copy editing.
Oh, cool.
It was delightful.
So you copy edited children's books?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And I even forget what my title was, but there's a, it was like a managing director, all that, like assistant managing director, whatever it is. So it was two jobs. It was one, copy editing children's books, which is really exciting because I was working with this wonderful editor named Neil Porter, who while I was there had just won like what, like he was in the process of winning his first Caldecott, which is like the highest honor you can get for a children's book.
Oh, wow.
So it was a wonderful, thrilling time.
What publishing house is this?
At Macmillan.
Okay.
Roaring Brook Press specifically. And now he has his own imprint. But then separately, I was also, I think I was what it was called, managing, I don't even know. Like basically the people who put the schedules together for all of the steps that have to go into creating and publishing a book. So it was a lot of Excel sheets and organizing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. You know, I got the interview from a recommendation of a friend who worked there and a meeting with the woman who is the managing director. And I was like, well, I don't really have any experience in book publishing. She's like, yeah, but don't sell yourself short. Like, look at your resume. I was like, oh no, you're right. I know. Like I'm going to kill it.
Yeah.
And she's like, you know, and she's like,
get my foot in the door.
Yeah. And she took a chance on me and it was great. It was so great. But I mean, you know, after a year, I was like, I can't keep making no money because you do not make any money in publishing. And I can live very cheaply. But that was, I was like, well, and then around the same time, like toward my year anniversary there, maybe like about 7 or 8 months in, Kurt Braunohler and Kristen Shaw called me and they said, we want to bring Hot Tub back because they had been doing it for years on and off at different venues like The Pit. And they hadn't done it in a few years. They're like, we want to bring it back, but we want someone to produce it so we don't have to book it and promote it. And so I was like, okay, I would love to do that. And so we started that at Littlefield And then a few months later, my old boss from comics that I'd mentioned, Rocky Dubin, she needed a hand at Bonnaroo because she booked the comedy at Bonnaroo for 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so she brought me on to do that as an associate comedy producer. And I was like, oh, man, I did miss it. And and at Bonnaroo that summer, I met an independent comedy promoter. And I was like, I feel like I'd like to work with you. And he's like, all right, I'll hire you. And so jumped over there full time. And
so where was that? That was in New York?
It was in New York. Yeah.
Great.
But yeah. Don't want to get into it too much. But
yeah,
it was very interesting. And yeah, got to, you know, see a lot of how an independent comedy promoter works. And it's hard. I mean, it was definitely an eye-opening experience to see, you know, if you're at a certain level and you're not working with Live Nation or AEG, there isn't always a place for you because AEG and Live Nation have the money to back up a tour.
Okay.
Whereas an independent promoter, you know, they have to find the money or you have to trust them that they're going to make this money for you. And it's a leap of faith for a lot of people.
So were you trying to get like sponsors?
No, I was doing more day-to-day logistics of tours that were already in place.
Okay. That seems very difficult to get like large scale sponsors. I was talking to the Brooklyn Comedy Festival people last year and it just sounds, daunting. Yeah.
I have no interest. I mean, that is the one thing where people are like, well, how do I make money or how do I get sponsors for my festival? I'm like,
I don't know. Yeah.
Like, go ask Charlena Bridgetown. I think she's the only one who has it figured out. But it's, I just had, you know, I'm sure I could figure it out, but it is just not something that interests me. And so, yeah, so I was there for a year and then I happened to be at an Onion, like Whiskey Friday. We used to, Fridays at the Onion's main office, we used to just drink whiskey on Friday.
I did not know that about the Onion, which started out of my college newspaper,
actually. Of course it did.
Yeah. That sounds fucking great.
It was great. I think it was kind of a combination of Baratunde Thurston and my friend Joe Garden, who was one of the original writers starting it, and it turned into a thing. And there was, you know, one day where I was like, I'm going to invite the Daily Show. And Baratunde's like, I'm going to call, who was it? Like, you know, Johnny Walker and see if they'll come and bartend. And we're like, great. And so it was a party and I had invited, and it just like that day, Beth Hoyt had reached out to me, who's a comedian and actress in LA. And she was like, hey, I'm starting this new thing. I want to talk to you about it. I was like, come to the Onion. And it was just like this insane drunken party and I was like, wait, what are we doing? And she basically, at the time, that's when YouTube was just kind of throwing money at different online outlets, and My Damn Channel was one of those. And they said, you know, we're giving you, here's this money, we're gonna do a live weekly talk show Wednesdays at 3 p.m that Beth Hoyt's gonna host, and we will have celebrity guests to interview. And so, you know, she was like, let's talk to Marianne. And I'm so glad she did, you know. So I wound up leaving the promoter and worked with My Damn Channel for a year just the talent booker. And it was great. And it was one of these things where we all had the same comedy sensibilities. And we sat down and we're like, okay. You know, I was like, here's my celebrity list. Here's who I can easily reach out to in the beginning. You know, and of course we can like go from there. And when we started, my first guest, I was so excited about. They were so excited about it. It was like David Wayne and David Cross and John Glazer and John Benjamin and all of these, you know, we had all these people on, and then the YouTube people that were watching were like, who are these old men? And we're like, okay, switching gears. So, but it was interesting because that was the time when social media influencers started to become a thing.
Yeah.
And so like
that we're all looking at 18-year-old boys to,
and it was to lead us. Crazy. And so, you know, like we had Grace Helbig on the network and Emory Hart.
She's great. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, this is what they want. So I'm like, who's Tyler Oakley? Is that an Oakley?
I don't know. Yeah.
But you do. Like, if you just saw him, you'd be like, oh, he's. And he, and like, so, you know, we started. It was great. It was a great exercise for me to reuse my, you know, PR background to start actually reaching out to publicists and like saying, this is what our show is. And here's why it would be good for your person to come on here. And here's how they would help us. And so, you know, I absolutely expanded my Rolodex and kind of got out of my comfort zone, which was lovely. And, but yeah, I was there for a year. I don't remember what I did after that. My timeline is so all over the place. I think I had my own company. I think I just was freelance booking and producing for about a year and a half.
Oh, you're like, oh, and then I just, oh, right, I started my own company.
I mean, I didn't make it an LLC at the time. So I was like, I don't know if I count it. But yeah, I just was.
Do you have that now?
I do.
Cool.
Yeah, I still don't know what I'm doing. Like, I talked to my accountant the other day. I was like, am I supposed to be paying myself? And he's like, we got to talk.
I just talked to my accountant this mm-hmm. morning, and she asked, okay, so I did this crazy thing. I cashed out my 401k yeah. this past year to, I quit my job. Oh, no. I know. Everyone said don't do it, but I'm so happy that I did it. I quit my full-time job, and I was just like, I need to throw myself 100% into writing and comedy. And my accountant was like, you owe $25,000. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? And mm-hmm. she meant to say... $2,500.
Get a new accountant.
Oh my God. What? I was having a heart attack. I ended up like have to owe like $7,000, which is fine. Whatever. Right. I sort of budgeted for that. But I thought I was going to die this morning.
Oh
anyway.
Oh my God. I'm glad you don't owe that much money.
Oh God.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the worst part about owning a company though, is when they're like, you owe $40,000. And you're like,
I didn't have that though.
Nope. It's crazy. Yeah. It's not fun. Get a good accountant. That's another tip.
Yeah.
Oh my God. People
the comedian. This woman is wonderful. But yeah, I think she just, it was a slip of the tongue, you know. Yeah.
I know. I'll say that a lot of comedians use brass taxes, I think is what it's called. Brass tax. Okay.
Brass tax. So I think I've heard it on a podcast. Yep. Yeah.
So after that, I have my own company and then ran into a friend who she used to book comedy at Bell House and Union Hall, and she was leaving to move to LA.
Okay.
And so she was like, you should meet with my boss. And so the guy who had been helping out with comedy at Bell House moved up to be the booker there. He's still there. He's great. And I became the full-time booker at Union Hall, which was exciting for me. Yeah. Cause it kind of brought me back to music finally. So it was music mm-hmm. and comedy and, you know, anything. And it was, and again, I'm a numbers person. So when I started, my boss was like, hey, maybe try to have less comedy, because for a bar, they are not making money on comedy shows. They're making money at the bar with drinks. And so when somebody goes to a comedy show, you might buy a drink in the beginning, but then you sit, you listen to the show for an hour and a half, you go home. Where with music, you get there, you have a drink, you listen to a band, you have a drink, you listen to another band, so you're drinking 3 or 4 drinks a night.
Oh.
But by this time, Union Hall wasn't necessarily known as the hip, cool place for music. Heather was great, but by this time, all of these venues had opened up in Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everyone's going to 285 Kent and Cameo, and which with rightly so. They were great venues for music.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, does Union Hall now even have bands?
They do.
Every once in a while?
I think so.
Yeah.
I'm actually not sure.
Yeah.
And I did my best to, you know, put bands in there. But what I did when I started was I created an Excel sheet where I took all of their bar rings, ticket sales, and capacity numbers from mm-hmm. the past 3 or 4 years, dumped them into an Excel sheet, and then made a pivot table that showed basically what the profit margins were between comedy, music, other, and they were making about the same amount of money.
Wow.
Because you sold more tickets at comedy, so you're getting revenue there, and a percentage of that stays with the bar. And then you're also selling a decent number of drinks, more than they thought.
Okay.
And the music wasn't selling well enough to have it make a difference. After I did that, my boss at Union Hall was like, hey, cool. You understand, you get it. Yeah. Just do whatever you want. And
awesome.
It was great. We had, I was there for 2 years, 2.5 years, maybe.
I love that you made charts and graphs. I know. Makes me wet. I'm so
that's why I'm here.
Oh God, this is making me so excited.
Did it really get you when I said pivot table?
Yeah.
So I was there, loved it. And that kind of let me be a little bit more creative again, because once I caught up, I had the time to, see performers again mm-hmm. and talk to people again. And someone would tell me an idea they had for a show, and I'm like, oh, well, you should talk to this person, and here you should maybe think about doing this with it. And I helped create some shows that are still around, and that makes me so happy, because I got, I decided to keep working. I never meant to work in comedy. I decided to keep working in comedy because I was like, well, I want to see people succeed.
Did it ever make you want to get on stage?
Never. I you can tell by this podcast, I'm not a funny person. You're very sweet.
We're talking about organization. Yeah. This is riveting to me.
Well, I will organize the shit out of anything having to do with comedy. But writing comedy is a skill mm-hmm. that you, maybe if I worked really hard, I could get there. But one of the first quote unquote jobs I had, I think I was still just volunteering in comedy, was I think a year in I don't know. It was through Kevin Allison. Mm-hmm. Like I met him through David Wayne, and at the time he was teaching a sketch writing class, mm-hmm. and his assistant was leaving, and the assistant was like, "Well, you seem organized," and I was like, "Yeah." And she said, "Do you want to be his teaching assistant?" I said, "Sure." And there was one class where he like forced me to write a sketch with someone. He's like, "Just try it." It was the biggest piece of garbage I've ever seen.
He probably thought like, "Oh, I'm going to show her into the light and she'll never stop performing and writing."
Not everyone needs to be funny. It's it's almost better that way.
I think it's kind of hard. It would be hard to produce full time and
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that was the other reason I got into it was, you know, I knew a great producer and I loved what she did, but also it was one of those things where I was like, "Oh, you guys are working really hard. You shouldn't have to do this."
Yeah.
You know, someone could take this stuff off your plate, especially someone who likes doing it, you know, and it was just really just me being helpful. So eventually it became a job.
Oh my God. So after Union Hall.
Oh yeah. After Union Hall.
We don't have to go through every piece. I think it's a very interesting career.
Yeah. It's all over the place. So while I was at Union Hall, I did not want to leave. And I got a call from an agency that said, "Do you want to be an agent?" I said, "Absolutely not." Because again, at this time, like I just really, it's not that I avoided the industry. I just hadn't needed to work with the industry because I was working at such a lower level on purpose. Like I was limiting what I was doing because that's the level I really loved working on, was the 100 capacity rooms and the workout rooms and the where people get to be creative while they're trying to figure out what their hour is or their, you know, what they want to do with their life. And so I said, "I don't want to be an agent." And they're like, "Will you at least talk to us?" And I happened to be flying to LA the next week to produce the state's 20-year anniversary show.
Oh, cool.
And I was like, "All right, I'll be there. I'll come meet with you." Mm-hmm. And I met with them and they were amazing. And I was like, "Oh, you're like real people." Oh, I didn't know that was a thing, that they're agents that care about comedy, which it turns out a lot of them do. I just had painted this picture in my head of these like four horrible interactions suits I had found or I'd had. And so, yeah, I was like, "Oh, okay." And then they called me back and had me meet with like the owner of the company. And I got back to New York and they're like, "All right, we want to bring you on as an agent, like a full-blown agent, not like an assistant." And I really struggled with whether or not I should take it. And I like went and like just, I was like, I should seek out my mentors and ask them their advice. And all of them were like, "You know, it's a great opportunity." And for me, because I'm so type A and so organized, believe it or not, I don't love freelancing. I like office jobs. This whole time I've had office jobs, you know, I like stability. I like organization. I like, you know, my office jobs have never been, you leave it at the door when you leave, but there's something about that where it's like, "Oh yeah, this is great." And so I was like, "All right, I'm going to do it." They were wonderful. I was a great agent. I was a PA agent. So like touring, comedy tours. I loved our roster. I loved the clients I worked with. I hated the work.
Okay. What about it?
Everything.
I don't know. I mean,
so a touring agent, basically it's different at every company. At our company, it was, you know, you have a roster that you're servicing and it's getting them on the road. Mm-hmm. So at different levels, you know, different types of venues, every agent had a different territory and type of venue that they serviced. So, I call them my work wife and I, we split the country down the middle. And I had, you know, east of the Mississippi pretty much. And well, it's not the middle, but you get it. Yeah. And we focused on colleges, festivals, and alternative venues, which would be like a Union Hall. So alternative just means it's not a comedy club. It's not an arena. It's not a theater. And, you know, so it was figuring out who wants to be on the road, how many tickets they can sell, what are the venues that would service them. Okay. For me, it was a lot of digging out new venues because alternative venues were like kind of newer to us at the time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was working like 60, 70 hours a week. And
would
just
you go
so
scope
stressed
any of these places?
No, because they were all out of town.
Right.
But, you know, we get on the phone and the venues loved me because I spoke their language. And I, you know, my boss was great. Like the first week that I was there, a manager had, you know, they like forwarded me something. Like they were like, "I tried to negotiate this offer. I couldn't get more money. Can you try?" And they're not supposed to try to do that. And I called my boss like the first week. I called my boss. I was like, "What do I do? Do I just tell them I need more money because of A, B, and C?" He's like, "Is that true?" And I was like, no. He's like, well, don't lie to anyone. He's like, oh, oh, don't lie.
Sorry. I thought I was an agent.
Exactly. And so, you know, I was like, okay. And I, you know what? I got that comedian more money by telling the truth. And, you know, he was like, don't ask for more than they're worth. And it was like great. It was a great place. It was a great place to learn and to work. I'll also back up by saying this is something I think that I'm sure people are talking about on podcasts. Maybe they're not. I didn't know the difference between an agent and a manager until years ago.
Please explain. Yeah. We haven't touched on that at all on this podcast. So, yeah.
I mean, you know, there's no one right answer because all agents and managers are different. But a manager is someone who kind of works with you to decide what you want to be doing and the path that's best to take in order to get the things that you want. And they're kind of more like a friend and a mentor. An agent gets you the jobs. It's as simple as that, whether it's an acting job, a writing job, you know, a touring job. And again, this is not black and white. Like, there are a lot of agents who actually act like managers, and there are a lot of managers that act like agents. So, I learned a lot. It was a great experience. Had it been at any other agency, I would have lasted 3 months. I stayed a year and a half, and we're all still really good friends.
You're just like, that's not the work that inspires me.
It wasn't the work that inspired me. It was also, it's stressful. Like, I mean, now I have better relationships with agents and managers at every other company because I was like, oh, I get it. I respect what you do and you do care.
Right.
And you, some are terrible.
I'm sure it helps to produce being in the shoes of the,
absolutely. Yeah, of all these people. It's, you know, there's one agent that I love that I was working on a casting gig and she was calling me at like 8 p.m. on a Jewish holiday. I'm like, what? And on like a Friday. And it was not a ton of money, but she really wanted her client to get it. And I'm like, I love you for helping me. Like, but it's things like this where I was like, I have to turn it off at some point.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's just for 10 minutes, it was the most stressful job I've ever experienced. And and I left to, you know, do my own thing. And here we are now. And then I've just been, I don't know, I work very hard, but I'm also very lucky. And,
So now this is your full thing is producing your shows.
That's honestly, I'm producing live shows in Brooklyn for fun.
Okay.
Yeah, that is not where I make my money at all. it's a passion project. You know, it's all passion projects. Right now I sign so many NDAs. I work with a brand to produce live comedy events for them.
Oh, cool. Great.
I just did the casting for the stand-up comedians for Two Dope Queens on HBO.
Great.
Working on Bonnaroo again, you know, this year. So It's the bigger clients, 100%.
Right. And you get those jobs from, I mean, all of this. Yeah. And also, like, the Brooklyn shows are a passion project, but they also keep you at the top of people's minds, I'm sure. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, they'll pay my cell phone bill or something. They're not going to pay my rent, but they're going to pay my bills.
Oh, I hear you.
And I love it. And it keeps me connected. And, like, you know, when... So after Hot Tub moved to LA, right on the heels of that, in its place, I started Night Train with Wyatt Cenac. Mm-hmm. And when we ended that at our 5-year anniversary, I again had to sit down and think, like, I don't need to keep doing a Monday night show, because actually, like, people in the industry take me less seriously, I think, because I still have my hands in these bar shows. But for me, I was like, you know what? I'm miserable every Monday. And then I walk in here and I'm like, I don't want to do a show. And then the show starts and the comedians start showing up. And I am so happy. It's really like every week is like a little family reunion, you know?
Yeah.
And I still get so much joy out of watching comedy. And so
did you reach out to the three hosts of that, who are Aparna and Maeve Higgins and Joe Firestone? Did you put them together great.
Yeah. So I had I just sat down and made a wish list of like what 10 comedians I would love to work with every week.
Yeah.
Some of them had to come off that list because I was like, they travel too much.
Yeah.
You know, Maeve was at the top of my list, and then Joe and Aparna have worked together a lot before, and so they were at the top of my list. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was sitting there and I was like, well, why not all three of them?
Yeah.
They're all wonderful. They all like each other. They all live in the neighborhood. And
that's great.
And they're all traveling a lot.
And then when they're out of town, it's totally fine.
Exactly. And that's kind of how I pitched it to them. I was like, hey, guys, I would love to do a show with you. I realize it's a big commitment, but here's what I'll do, which is everything but perform.
Yeah.
And
they're like, okay.
Yeah. And they're like, I was like, you just have to show up when you're in town and host. And they were like, we love this. We're into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'll say, like, so when I start a show like that, what I do is I have like an unending database of all of the comedians. It's not even close to all of the comedians, but it's so many comedians. And I will take a truncated version of that and pretty much just send, you know, the top 2,000 comedians in New York and ones that visit from LA a lot. And I will create a Google Doc, an Excel sheet. And
I have a Google Doc of comedians too.
Of course. Of course. And as you should.
Yeah.
And I will just, you know, label it like the name of the comic, put their initials of like the host up there. And I just say, like, put a yes down if you like them, put a no down if you'd rather not have them on this show, and leave a blank if you don't know them. And that's, they all did that. And we all came up with a show name together. Like, this one was Joe's suggestion. We loved it. And that's how I started booking the show. I was like, okay, well, all three of you matched on these 75 comedians. So, I'll start there. So then we get a sense of, like, you know, who we like. And I'll, you know, I'll just pick and choose, like, curate lineups from who they loved. And, you know, so far, so good.
Yeah. No, yeah. So the show's doing very well.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
I love it. It makes me so happy. Like, it's really such a, just a joy to watch them. Like, all three of them.
Also, I think the new Littlefield is much more comedy friendly. No? Because the stage is lower. And it's a little smaller.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. Those are good things.
Yeah. What?
Yes. Nothing. No, okay. I will never say a bad word about Littlefield.
I love Littlefield.
I hate change.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Totally understandable.
Absolutely. It's still a great venue to watch comedy.
You're still trying to get a drink on the other side of the room. And yeah.
I say nothing.
Yeah. No, it's
but
hard. Yeah,
but it's still, yes. And, you know, the problems that I experience are not problems that will ever affect the comedy goers' experience. And that's really all that matters. The comedians are happy. The, you know, the crowd is happy. Yeah. And that's all that matters. It's a great show. It is a great, great space.
Yeah. Lovely.
Yeah. Of course, there are silly, like, logistical producer nightmares, but whatever. You work with it.
Yeah.
And they're truly wonderful people. So that is a huge difference. Yeah. I talked about myself for an hour.
No, that's great. I would love to get your pet peeves on shit that comics, because I feel like people that are listening are producers, but also they're just going to want to hear your story and know that you're a producer. Talk about things that annoy you that comics do and what they shouldn't do. And then we'll wrap up.
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. I hate it when a comedian will email me and ask to do the show and not include a clip. That's simplest thing.
Yeah.
You have to send a clip.
Somebody emailed me yesterday and they're like, we have a musical. We want it. And it was so long. And,
for you.
And then they didn't send me a tape. And I'm like, I'm not going to respond to you.
Yeah.
Like, you, no.
Absolutely.
You need to know that you need to send a tape of your 15-minute musical about the 1950s. Yeah. I have no idea what the hell that is.
Yeah. I mean, like, and I get it. You're trying, like, sometimes you're trying to be nice by being like, should I send you a clip? And I'm like,
just do it.
That's fine, but I'm never going to respond to you.
Yeah.
Like, I'm never going to respond. Like, I have so many people who are sending me introductions and clips that I cannot respond to everyone. So they go into a folder.
Right.
And I'm not deleting them. When I need someone for the show, which is rare, except now on this show, we have a 5-minute like guest spot for people. And it's not even for up and comers. It's just people I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that is on me. But like, I'm never going to take the time to write you back. This is not my full-time job.
Yeah.
Like, I, you know, and I hate to be like that bitch that's like, send me a tape.
That's very silly.
I mean, it's definitely a pet peeve when, you know, people don't have a website. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But even if it's just a Facebook page, take a minute, write yourself a 2-sentence bio, even if it's just, this is where I'm from and I've been doing comedy for this long.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Fine. You know, if you've done bar shows, put the bar shows on there. Like, it's, you know, so other people can see your credits. You'll build up your credits. I mean, this is a pet peeve that I didn't even know I had to worry about until a few years ago. If I've had multiple comedians while I'm running a show walk up to me in the sound booth and try to introduce themselves to me.
No.
While I'm working.
No.
No. And like, there's one comedian who keeps trying to get on my shows that did this to me a year ago. And all of his friends are like, you got to give him a chance. And I was like, I'm still pissed at him. And it literally was like a week ago that I was like, fine, I'm done being pissed. But like, and they're like, well, they don't know any better. I'm like, well, okay, that's fair. But also it's common courtesy. Like, I would never walk up to you at your job and be like, do you have like just 10 minutes for me to tell you all about myself?
Yeah, no.
No, you're busy.
Right.
Yeah.
Would you be mad if somebody did that to you after a show, if you were like having a drink or something?
No.
Okay.
I wouldn't be mad. Yeah, you know, I don't love it, but it is appropriate.
Yeah.
You know, it's absolutely fine. And I have it happen all the time. unfortunately, usually it doesn't help me remember them, but it is a it's fine to follow up. Like, it's fine to say like, hey, I sent you a clip. I really love your show. I'd love to be considered. Should I follow up? And I'm usually like, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And sometimes I do. Like, it's for me, people tend to think that I am just like, I don't know, like too busy and too good. Like, I don't think anyone's funny, or I'm not responding to people. Like, I just ignore people. I'm just busy. It sucks. Like, so many people are doing it right. Even my friends who I love who have done the show, where I'm just like, I mean, right now, what day is this? Is April like 8th? I'm booked up through the end of May.
Yeah.
Because I have five spots per show, and there are people that I love.
There are thousands and thousands and thousands of fucking comedians.
Right. And like, I mean, it kills me that someone I love, like Mike Kaplan's going to do the show once a year. Mm-hmm. Once a year.
Yeah.
He lives in the neighborhood. He helps me out when I need him.
Yeah.
He's so funny. The audience loves him.
But still once a year. Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's like, in that case, they're not doing anything wrong. Nobody's doing anything wrong. It's fine to send an email. It's fine to follow up 6 months later. You know, don't follow up every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, it definitely drives me crazy when someone emails me and Facebooks me, and then will get my number and text me. I'm like, are not allowed to text me. You'll be blocked immediately.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think texting is only if somebody has explicitly said they're okay with
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And like, honestly, this is probably unfair of me, but I don't really read Facebook messages, mm-hmm. personal ones at all. Because in my mind, if you're good enough to do the show, which again, I don't have the best show in the world. It's not like, you know, you have to
earn it. But it has a great reputation.
It has a good reputation. It's a good room. And it's just that there's so much quantity. But like, if you are good enough and you've been doing the rounds and you have like, you're like, you know what? Why have I not done the show? If you cannot find my email.
That's on you.
That's on you. Absolutely. And you know, that's absolutely a thing, is like, you know, you can ask another comedian for my email,
mm-hmm.
and if it's a comedian I know and trust, they usually email me and they're like, hey, can I give out your mail? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Or like, occasionally I'll get recommendations. Like, there are a few comics that I'm not going to say their names because I'll get bombarded, but I trust them so much, and they will recommend comedians to me all the time. They're like, hey, I don't think you've seen the person. I'm like, great. And it's almost an automatic book. I'll still get a tape, but like, you know, especially Joe Aparna and Maeve, like, we have a sheet where I'm like, put anyone you want in there.
Yeah.
They will get an automatic book.
Yeah, they're hosting it.
Right.
Yeah.
But like, that's not to say that they, you know, they get requests all the time.
Right.
And sometimes they're like, I haven't seen this person in a year. And, you know, it's rare that, I think only twice. They've only twice asked me like, hey, this is a really good friend of mine who's coming into town. And they always say, if you like them, can you book them? It's not about what they like. For me, it is.
Yeah.
But they don't think it is. You know, they want to make sure that it's like, they trust me completely with the lineup. So do not bombard them with requests, because it's not going to help.
Leave them alone.
Yeah.
So, well, they're not even like on Facebook. They are smart about it. They are very smart.
Absolutely.
Wow. This has been great. I feel like we should probably, you have to go to a bus. I feel like I could ask you questions forever
I want to give advice. What else do comedians need to know quickly? What else do they always ask?
Ugh. Oh, well, mostly, I mean, we talk about on this show, just like, for producing, they ask, like how to get in, how to fill up a room, and how to get in the rags, like how to get like written up.
Yeah,
and stuff.
I mean, that's what I was going to say earlier. Is like, my advice won't be like anyone else's advice, because I'm at a point where I don't need to be doing this, and so I won't start a new show unless there's a celebrity attached. So just, you know, as my friend last night, Shannon, who you mentioned that booked Union Hall after me, she was like, yeah, I just tell people, just sell your own network TV show, and then maybe you can get a show at Union Hall and sell tickets. Like, there's, you know, people are so spoiled now. So it's really just have a really good show, start it with people you trust. If there's someone that's not funny, that is your friend, don't start a show with them, because then you're just gonna have a shitty show.
Yeah, that's a very good
point. And you're
gonna
get the audience coming 1 week, and they're not gonna come back.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, you don't have to throw spots at people that you do not think are funny. Like, you know,
there's so much pressure as a producer and comedian to book people that you don't think are funny. And I mean, I think starting a show, sometimes, you have a great friend who's just like not there, doesn't do the work, is just never going to be funny.
Absolutely. Go start a show with someone else, and you might burn a bridge, but they should understand and they should get better. And then the only other thing I usually tell people is if you're producing a show, it is your responsibility, basically in my mind, to make sure the comedians don't have to worry about anything but their set. whatever that means, whether it's booking the show, dealing with the venue, if someone is talking in the audience, if, you know, like, you always give the comedian the first chance to shut it down.
Yeah.
But if it keeps going, you gotta, if as long as it's safe, you have to step in. Like,
yeah,
it's your job. If someone's smart. On there, if people are on their phones the whole time, ask them to stop.
Do you go up to people? Absolutely. Great. All the time.
If I see someone on their phone, I'm like, hey, I'm so sorry. We ask that you keep your phone in your pocket or you can step out to the bar.
Yeah.
And only once did I have someone almost hit me in the face because he pulled out his phone because somebody gave him shit for being a Trump supporter. And he just wanted a fight. And I was like, okay, look, you can be here, but you gotta... He just started, like, playing games on his phone. I was like, just leave, you know?
So he... Did he leave?
Yeah. I grabbed one of the big bartenders to help me kick him out. Mm-hmm. It took a while, but we got him out.
God.
It sucked. Yeah. And again, you gotta be safe. But, like, to me, that's my response. You know, my responsibility is the... Make sure the room's dark enough. Make sure the comedians have light and sound. Like, this is, you know, my job to worry about, so they don't have to. They shouldn't have to do that. So...
I had a thing about producing, about filling up the room or something.
Oh yeah, you did say how to get listed. There are so many comedy shows that all you can do is try.
I think getting credits on your shows, if you have a couple credits,
it doesn't help. I don't know. I don't think it does. I mean, maybe it does a little bit. Like, I know, you know, some places are like, well, yeah, if you submit an event listing, absolutely, it's helpful if you're listing the names of the comedians and putting their credit next to their name, even if it's just they've done the Brooklyn Comedy Festival, they've done Comedy the Knitting Factory. Yeah, include that, because then that's even less work that the person with the newsletter has to do.
This is what I wanted to say. Mm-hmm. On the topic of promoting, I think that you're saying the comics should just come in and do comedy. It drives me nuts when other producers are like, hey, you're on my show. I really am expecting you to promote it. I'm like, okay, so I have 7 shows this week. So what, you want me to just promote? That's all I'm supposed to be doing is promoting your show. What about my, you know, like, I have to worry about my shows. You know, I don't know. Yeah. That like makes me fucking crazy. Like, you can say like, hey, here's the event if you want to share it. But if you're like, it's on you to make people, like, no, it's not on me.
I agree with you.
When you're doing like 25 or 30 shows a month, like, no.
Yeah. And if you can't get people in the door at your show, then stop doing a show because there are too many shows.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And like, I'm the same way. There have only been 1 or 2 times, I think, in 8 years, maybe like a dozen times, when I've been like, hey guys, again, you don't have to, but like, sales are a little light. If you have a chance to tweet, go for it.
Yeah.
I'm never relying on them because
it's not their responsibility. This
is on me.
Yeah.
Like, if I can't, you know, fill a room, then I'm doing something wrong, or I'm not doing anything wrong. It's just, again, there are too many comedy shows, and that's when I'll, you know, there are absolutely times after we started the show, we were doing great, great, great. And then all of a sudden it just dropped off and I was having to get a headliner a week, which sucked. But, you know, I had to just rebuild the trust of the audience and just say like, hey, no, really, we're still here. Even then
Why do you think it fell off? Just like the natural. I don't know.
It could have been the weather.
Yeah.
We honestly, like, a comedian came on who I put up first in the show and did untested, racy material that was very unlike this person.
Okay.
And lost the audience from the get-go.
And then it was a...
And we never... And, like, it was a very tricky show. Because it was a lot of people who were very serious and or, like, slow-build comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do not have that person going first on the lineup that just, like, gets the audience, they don't trust you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't... And the next week is when it started dropping. And I don't know if that's why... I think it was probably that combined with the weather, combined with there are a lot of other, whatever it was, I don't know. And it took me 4 weeks to rebuild it.
Wow.
Maybe 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And it was really rough. And it's like, if the audience doesn't trust you, they're not going to come to your show.
Yeah.
They want, especially me, they want the top, you know, the top level comedy, whatever.
Right. No, absolutely.
I want to give that to them.
There is this unpredictable element of like, we did everything we could do and it just didn't, this one just didn't work, you know?
There's really, I mean, for the most part in general, especially for smaller shows, there's no rhyme or reason.
Yeah.
You do your best. But again, there are too many damn shows because there are too many comedians.
There are too many comedians.
Yeah. So it's hard. It's hard. I don't envy anyone starting a new show with comedians who don't have their own TV shows.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard.
Me? Yeah.
But I'm happy they're doing it because there are a lot of great shows. And like, you know, again, I only have so many spots. And I want these comedians to get up every night and I can't help them. So
Right. Absolutely.
What are you going to do?
Well, thank you so much for coming on. This was so delightful. Is there anything you would like to plug or where people can find you or your shows or?
No, I'm good. No, I
don't go to Butterboy. Don't go.
Sure. Yeah. Butterboy every Monday night at Littlefield in Brooklyn. Sashir's and Made a Party Time once a month at Bell House. I don't know. I have all these great David Cross shows. We have more coming up. If I updated my website, I'd say go there. It's kind of up to date, but I have a website. Sure enough.
Is it MaryAnnWays.com?
That's it. Follow me on Instagram, guys. I need more followers.
Me too.
MWays.
All right. Yeah. I'm going to follow you on Instagram.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. That sounds okay. MWays on Instagram.
Yeah.
What's mine? Emily McWinter, I think. Okay. I need more followers. I really do. I post pictures of my dog. Okay.
It's a good dog.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to How to Produce Live Comedy. If you like the show, please rate and review it on iTunes. And you can donate to me and my producer on Venmo at Emily-Winter. To find me online, visit my website, emilywintercomedy.com, or follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Emily McWinter. It's Emily MC Winter. You can find photos from shows I produce on our network website, brainmachinenetwork.com. Thanks so much.